click on Learn, what drops down is a tab where you can find all of our Emmaus Essentials classes. If you were to click here, it would open up this Emmaus Essentials page. There's an archive here of previous studies. But here is a link to the study through the attributes of God. You click on that and it will open up this particular page, which has the schedule here. And so you'll see that today, April the 22nd, we're going to offer some introductory remarks on the attributes of God by A.W. Pink. The lesson outline will be posted here. Also, recommended reading homework is here. So for next Sunday, you should read chapter 1 on the solitariness of God. We are out of books. I'm sorry. I just realized we're out of books. It's available in PDF format online. It's available, on the Kindle, too, if you'd like that. But if you want a book, let me know, and I'll order it this week, and it'll be here by next Sunday. I apologize. I didn't realize we had run out. But you'll see here that each week we will post the teaching outline all the way through to the end of the study. We're going to take 20 lessons to cover this book. Sometimes we will cover two chapters, but mainly one chapter a week. This will take us all the way through to September the 23rd. I'll just have you note this, that there will be a couple of Sundays where we do not have class. One is coming up pretty soon. No class on Sunday, May the 6th. I'll be gone preaching at a church up in Placerville, on the way to the General Assembly in North Dakota. We'll be flying out of Sacramento then and then coming back that way. So no class on Sunday, May the 6th, and then also a little further down here, no class on July the 15th. I think that's because I'm going to be away with the family on vacation on that Sunday. But you get the idea of where we're going, don't you? So all that's available on our website, and I'd encourage you to use that. We had this outline, the schedule in print form, but again, we're out of those two, so we're out of everything this morning, and I apologize for that. The book looks like this. Anyone want to hold up the newer edition? Yeah, it looks different, doesn't it? So the page numbers might not correspond, but I think that's the newer book. You guys all have it. I guess those are the ones I bought. I don't know where I got this one. The orange, though, it really pops. You know, you really notice it here. I wanted to take some time and say some things about A.W. Pink before we get into the book that he wrote called The Attributes of God. A.W. Pink was an interesting character, and it's helpful to know something about his life and about his work. There are some stereotypes that people have concerning A.W. Pink. Does anyone know what they are? When you hear the name, what do you think of him as a person, his personality, his character? Anyone at all? Anything come to mind? You think of A.W. Tozer. They're contemporaries. They both wrote on the attributes of God. And actually, they have this in common. They both spent time bemoaning the sorry state of the church in their day. They had that in common. They were deeply concerned about the low state of the church, a lack of holiness, a lack of reverence for God within the church. So yeah, you have two A.W.s, A.W. Pink and A.W. Tozer. Chad, did you have a thought?
Wasn't he weird?
He was odd. He was odd. He was a different character. He was a bit of a recluse, especially in his later years, a bit antisocial, struggled very much in the pastorate, actually, would move from church to church early on in his ministry, couldn't seem to find a home, a place to minister. He was kind of unwanted as a pastor, to where eventually he just decided to relegate himself to the writing ministry, to the written word. We have to be careful here that we don't misunderstand him, though. In fact, I think he was a very tender individual, a very caring individual, one who cared deeply about the church, but he was a product in some ways of his time. Brother, did you have something? Remind me of your name. Yeah, a modern Puritan. Would you remind me of your name, brother?
Steve.
And? Stephanie. Thank you. I appreciate that. In fact, his wife once reported that he himself had said that he was born 300 years too late. He felt like he would have been comfortable amongst the Puritans, whom he so enjoyed reading. I also think he was born about 100 years too early. I tend to wonder if he wouldn't have enjoyed fellowship in some of these Reformed Baptist churches that have since sprung up, in part due to his writings, the influence of his writings. A.W. Pink and his writings on the sovereignty of God, on the attributes of God, on Calvinism, etc., I think did help to really spur on the modern Reformed Baptist movement that we are now able to participate in. So I wonder if not only was he born 300 years too late, but maybe about 100 or 75 years too early. He had a hard time finding a home. And so I'm taking too much time here with introductory remarks. Here is what I would do. If you're interested in the life of A.W. Pink, I would highly recommend this biography written by Ian Murray, The Life of Arthur W. Pink. It was very encouraging to read. I just finished it a couple of weeks ago, but was very blessed by reading this biography, very edifying, and gave me a much more clear picture on who A.W. Pink was. Obviously, it would be very difficult for me to condense this for our time together, but I did go online and I found a very short biography written by Earl Hulse. I think that's how you pronounce his last name, Errol Hulse. This is available online. And I'd like to just read it to you. Okay, I know this is a different approach. I don't typically just read things, but you know, it's about 4 pages long here. It's not super short, but it's a nice condensed version of what is found in Ian Murray's biography. It'll give us a sense of who the man was. Concerning Calvinism and Arminianism during the first half of the 20th century, a most interesting case study is the experience of Arthur W. Pink. He was a preacher and writer of outstanding talent who ministered in Britain, America, and Australia. When he died in 1952 in isolation on the island of Lewis in northeastern Scotland, he was hardly known outside a small list of subscribers to his magazine, which was called Studies in the Scriptures. Yet by the 1970s, his books were in wide demand, and his name was widely known among publishers and ministers. In fact, for that period, it would be difficult to find a Reformed author whose books were more widely read. The preaching ministry of A.W. Pink had been remarkably blessed in the USA, but it was in Australia that he seemed to reach the apex of his public ministry, and there in particular that his preaching ministry reached great heights. He was then faced with accreditation by the Baptist Union and was rejected on account of his Calvinistic views. He then ministered in a Baptist church of strict Baptist pedigree. There he came unstuck since they esteemed him an Arminian. They were hyper-Calvinists, in fact, and they thought he was too loose. A considerable group, however, appreciated Pink, recognized his worth, and seceded from that strict Baptist church to form a new church of 27 members. Then suddenly, in 1934, Pink resigned and returned to Britain. It is widely held that one rejection is enough to cripple a minister for life, but two, in quick succession, can destroy a pastor completely. So it proved for Arthur Pink. He never again found meaningful entrance into the ministry, though he tried his utmost. He sought openings in both the UK and the USA without success. He became increasingly isolated. He ended his days as an evangelical recluse in the island of Stornoway off the coast of Scotland. It was rumored that not more than 10 souls attended his funeral. There is much that we can learn from the life of A.W. Pink. Firstly, we will trace out his early life in broad outlines. Secondly, we will describe his experience in Australia and trace out the adverse effects of this on his life. Thirdly, we will consider the impact of his writing ministry. So let's talk for a moment about his early life. Arthur Pink was born in Nottingham, England in 1886. His parents were godly. They lived by the Bible and kept the Lord's Day holy. Arthur was the first of three children brought up in the fear and admonition of the Lord. To the grief of their parents, all three children drifted into lives of unbelief. Worse was to come. Arthur embraced theosophy, an esoteric cult that claimed power over the occult. Lucifer was the name of the leading theosophy magazine. A natural feature of Arthur's character was wholeheartedness, and he entered theosophy with zeal. A leadership role was offered to him, which meant that he would visit India. At the same time, a friend who was an opera singer noted that Arthur possessed a fine baritone voice. He urged him to study for a career in opera. Then, suddenly, on a night during 1908, Arthur was converted. His first action was to preach the gospel to the theosophist group. Simultaneously with Pink's conversion was the call to the Christian ministry. But the colleges were in the hands of liberals bent on the destruction of the scriptures. Arthur, however, heard of the Moody Bible Institute, which had been founded by D.L. Moody in 1889. In 1910, at age 24, Pink left for Chicago to begin a 2-year course. His time at Moody lasted only 6 weeks, however. He decided that he was wasting his time and that he should enter directly into a pastorate, and his professors agreed with him. He was not disgruntled, but rather frustrated that the teaching was pitched at such a primary level that it did nothing for him. During 1910, he began his first pastorate in Silverton, Colorado, a mining camp in the San Juan Mountains. We possess little detail of this period, but we know from Silverton, Pink moved to Los Angeles. He was always a hard worker, and this is illustrated by the fact that at one point in Oakland, he was engaged in tent evangelism 6 nights a week for 18 weeks. From Los Angeles, he moved to Kentucky. It was here that he met and married Vera E. Russell. There could not have been a better gift from heaven. Vera was entirely committed to the Lord. She was hardworking, gifted, intelligent, and persevering. She died just 10 years after Arthur's decease on the island of Stornoway. The next move was to Spartanburg, South Carolina, from 1917 to 1920. This church building consisted of a small and frail wooden structure. While he and Vera lived in a small wooden house standing on wood columns, heating was inadequate, and in the freezing winter, it was like an ice box. It was during this time Pink began writing books. There were two of significance, one with the title Divine Inspiration of the Bible, and the second, The Sovereignty of God, the foreword of which is dated June 1918. It was this book that was later taken up by the Banner of Truth publishers. The first edition, according to I.C. Herendeen, his first publisher at the time, was only 500 copies, and it was a struggle to sell that number. When the book came to Banner, it was edited by Ian Murray and vastly improved. It became one of the most popular of the Banner of Truth paperbacks. By 1980, 92,000 copies have sold. So you see how he was very unpopular during his life, but after his death, his writings just exploded. He gained vast popularity. After about a year at Spartanburg, Pink almost came to grief. He felt a strong conviction to give up the ministry and devote himself to writing only, and at one point was disconsolate. Disconsolate. Okay, I've never said that word before, I think. It was a rough first go at it. Vera wrote to a friend saying that her husband was even thinking of leaving the ministry and going into business to make money for the kingdom as a better way of serving God. In 1920, Arthur resigned the pastorate at Spartanburg. He and Vera moved and settled at Swingle, Pennsylvania, in order to be near the publisher I.C. Herendeen. In the middle of July 1920, he left to take a series of meetings in California. Large crowds gathered and numbers were saved. At one point, 1,200 gathered to hear the gospel. Other crusades and conferences followed. It was evident that Pink was eminently suited to this kind of ministry. Looking back over his life, it is apparent that he experienced more blessings in the itinerant ministry than he did in a total of 12 years in pastoring churches. This had to do with his temperament. He preferred being in his study to visiting. In 1921, Arthur and Vera were back in Pennsylvania. The monthly digest, The Studies of the Scriptures, first appeared in 1922. It ran continuously without interruption for 32 years, until Arthur's death in 1952. Initially, this was a 24-page magazine with 4 or 6 articles as installments in a series. To write expository material at a high standard at this rate every month is a tremendous testimony to his insight into the Scriptures and to the Lord's blessing and enabling. All his articles had to be written by hand and finished for the printer at least 2 months before the date of publication. Studies in the Scriptures had about 1,000 circulation at the beginning, but for most of its existence, the subscription level hovered at about 500. The financial side was always precarious, with only just enough to cover printing costs from 1 month to the next. Pink corresponded with some of his subscribers. Eventually, this formed his pastoral work. He would kind of pastor through writing in due time. Throughout, he was assisted by his very hard working wife, who acted as secretary. They never had a family, always lived very humbly, and managed always to make ends meet. This was made possible through a modest inheritance left him by his parents through gifts and through gifts that he received from his readers. During 1923, Arthur fell into a deep depression, which turned out to be a nervous breakdown. At this juncture, a young couple that had been greatly blessed by Pink's ministry came to the rescue, and Arthur was nursed through a period of several months of enforced rest, which brought him back to normal health. In 1924, a major new direction came by way of letters of invitation from a publisher in Sydney, Australia. Before departing for Australia, no less than 4 months' preparation had to be made for the studies. On his way to Australia, Pink engaged in more Bible conference speaking in Colorado, then in Oakland, California, and also San Francisco, from where he and Vera took ship across the Pacific to Sydney. Now the biographer does turn our attention to Pink's experience in Australia. The Pinks spent a total of 3.5 years in Australia. These times were for them the best, but also turned out to be the worst. Upon arrival, Arthur had more invitations than he possibly could fill. Initially, his ministry in Australia was a great success. Crowds gathered, churches were filled, believers were revived, and souls were brought to the Savior. Attendance swelled in every place that he preached. In the first year in Australia, Arthur preached 250 times. He would often work until 2 a.m. to keep studies and the scriptures going. The Pinks truly must have felt that at last they had found the place of permanent fulfillment. There was an evident power in his ministry. One mature believer declared that he drew people like a magnet and that he preached the whole counsel of God's word and was capable of preaching a sermon from every word of the text. Now, this period proved to be one of great joy. Pink was now 40 years old. He was preaching almost daily for over an hour. He would get home at 10 p.m. and then work until 2 a.m. He wrote, "Never before during our 16 years in the ministry have we experienced such blessing and joy in our souls, such liberty of utterance, and such an encouraging response as we have done in this highly favored portion of Christ's vineyard. We can be sure that a thrilling and powerful soul-saving ministry will arouse the fury of Satan," and so it proved to be the case when that old serpent, the devil, mounted a cunning counterattack. The Baptist Union leaders were fundamentally opposed to Calvinism. These leaders invited Arthur Pink to read a paper on human responsibility. Sadly, Pink did not realize that this was a plot to demote him in the eyes of the public, and in his sincere earnestness, he fell into the trap. Instead of declining this invitation, he presented the paper and then answered questions for over an hour. The result of this was that the Baptist Union of New South Wales published a statement that they agreed unanimously not to endorse his ministry. With that, they did not themselves clarify any doctrine, is that they did not agree with Pink's Reformed doctrine. They were fundamentally Arminian. The effect of this was that invitations dried up and Pink's wider effective ministry in Australia was drastically reduced. It was at this juncture that one of the strict and particular Baptist churches invited Pink to become its pastor. This church was known as the Belvoir Street Church. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. I think I've butchered many things in this reading here. Here, Pink was as busy as he had ever been in his life. He had preached 300 times in the year ending 1926. In addition to preaching 3 times a week at Belvoir Street, he preached in 3 different places in Sydney each week to an average of 200 at each meeting. He still managed to maintain studies in the scriptures by burning midnight oil. Trouble, however, was in store. The early part of the 20th century was a time of lack of clarity in doctrine. Sounds kind of like our day, doesn't it? One of the evidences of this was confusion over Calvinism, Arminianism, and hyper-Calvinism. Many churches polarized. The Baptist Union was Arminian, and the strict and particular Baptist tended to be hyper-Calvinist. This proved to be the case at Belvoir Street until about May 1927. The Pinks believed that they had found a permanent church home. What is hyper-Calvinism, brothers and sisters? We know what Arminianism is. I hope you know what Calvinism is. What is hyper-Calvinism? Tim? Okay, yeah. Mike? Okay, such an emphasis on sovereignty and a neglect of anything having to do with man's responsibility, that's hyper-Calvinism. It's unbiblical. It's just as unbiblical as Arminianism. And Pink did oppose it when he was at this church. He wholeheartedly opposed it, and it also led to a split. You know, so here is Pink trying to be faithful to the scriptures, emphasizing both the sovereignty of God and man's responsibility in these matters, and he's having a hard time finding a church home to minister in. Here the biographer turns his attention to the impact of Pink's writing ministry, and this is the last section and the briefest, I think. If history had progressed normally, Arthur Pink would have been forgotten. There are several leaders in each generation who are well known, but it is unlikely that their names will be remembered for very long. When Arthur Pink died, he was known only to a small circle of readers, about 500 worldwide, who read his monthly periodical. studies in the scriptures, which he had faithfully produced with the help of his wife Vera for 31 years. Yet after his decease, as his writings were collected and published as books, his name became very well known in the English-speaking evangelical world. During the 1960s and 1970s, there was a dearth of reliable expository writing. Pink's writings filled an important need. His expositions are God-centered, theologically compelling and reliable, as well as practical and experimental, having to do with holy living. That was precisely what was needed during a period of spiritual drought. Publishers discovered the value of his writings. The outcome was dramatic. For instance, Baker Bookhouse published 22 different titles by Pink, with combined total sales by 1980 of 350,000. By the same date, just three books, Sovereignty of God, Life of Elijah, and Profiting from the Word, totaled 211,000. Yet as contemporary Reformed authors have multiplied, so the demand for Pink's books have lessened. So we have more and more access to other good and sound Reformed authors today. We must remember that with the dawning of the 20th century, the mainline denominations had already suffered extensive losses to higher criticism and modernism. Such was the advance of modernism in the late 19th century and through the first half of the 20th century. Most Bible colleges and seminaries were lost to an agenda of unbelief and anti-Christianity. That might seem strange to you to hear that, but it's true. Instead of producing preacher pastors for the churches, men were sent out who emptied the churches. The most striking example is Methodism. The aggregate membership in Methodism grew to be the highest of the nonconformist churches, yet this denomination has been virtually annihilated by modernism. An unbelief in the inspiration of scriptures, in the Holy Scriptures, etc., etc. The writing of Pink provided not only food for the spiritually hungry, but as Ian Murray asserts, Pink has been immensely important in reviving and stimulating doctrinal reading at the popular level. The same can be said of a few other authors of the 20th century. Earl Hulls serves as associate pastor at Leeds Reformed Baptist Church in Leeds, England. Since 1970, he has edited and written extensively for Reformation Today, a bi-monthly international digest. He has authored numerous books and articles. Pastor Hulls studied theology at London Bible College and benefited from the ministry of Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones. He is the one who wrote this. This biography. He has since passed. So is that helpful in giving you some sense of who the man was, A.W. Pink, who we are going to be reading? I think his book on the attributes of God is really quite excellent. There are other excellent books on the attributes of God. And what you begin to see when you're reading Pink's books is that he is relying heavily upon Puritan authors that he himself enjoyed to read. He read extensively. I mean, I forget what the number is, but a ridiculous number of pages per year, you know. He was just reading constantly. I know that in this book on the attributes of God, you begin to see that it's Charnock's book on the attributes of God that seems to be behind a lot of what Pink is writing. He is referenced from time to time. And so the question I wanted to address briefly this morning is, how should we interpret Pink's reclusiveness? It actually is kind of troubling when you read a detailed account of his life to see that over time he kind of just gave up on trying to pastor in churches, and even, I think worse yet, he kind of gave up on even trying to be a part of churches, and he kept the Lord's Day. He was very adamant about his Sabbath keeping, but he kept it in isolation, which doesn't seem quite right, does it? Because we're not to neglect the assembling of ourselves together. The story goes something like this. When he did eventually move to Scotland, there were some sound conservative Reformed churches there, but they were Presbyterian. And he did at first try to join himself to them, and he was involved in prayer and whatnot and in the life of the church. But soon the churches in Scotland decided that unless a man was ordained in their ministry, they could not take part in public ministry at all. They were a little bit leery of Pink, probably because he held to Baptist convictions. And so even there, when he thought maybe he had finally found a home to be a part of, he began to withdraw even in Scotland. So he died in isolation. Ian Murray's book, I think, answers the question beautifully. How should we interpret Pink's reclusiveness? He admits that Pink's temperament might be partly to blame. I'm sure that it is. Perhaps he was too aggressive in his attempts to bring reform to churches. He stood for truth. Are we to commend him for that? yes. But it takes a degree of tactfulness and patience to bring reform and bring health to churches that need it. Perhaps he was a bit too blunt, you know, in his stand for truth. Perhaps he lacked what I call pastoral patience. I think we might critique Pink a bit on that point if we consider him as a pastor. But we should also consider the difficult situation that he found himself in. He wanted badly to find a church home, that is evident in his writings, but was unable to do so. I think at one point, Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones did remark about Pink, if I took Pink's approach, I wouldn't be preaching to anyone. That's my paraphrase of it. In other words, I think Jones understood that Pink was a bit too harsh. Lloyd-Jones took more of a patient approach in his preaching. But notice this also. There is a quote from Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones here on the back of this biography. And here is what he says. Don't waste your time reading Barth and Bruner. Very prominent, renowned theologians. I think they're not worth reading also. I agree with them because they're flawed to the core. But they are well-known theologians. Don't waste your time reading Barth and Bruner. You will get nothing from them to aid you with preaching. Read Pink. Lloyd-Jones says, right? So though on the one hand he was critical of Pink, saying his approach might not have been quite right, which led to his reclusiveness and his isolation, he does admit that his writings are indeed very powerful and helpful to the minister in preaching and gaining sound doctrine. He did, I think, want badly to find a church home, but was unable to. Martin Lloyd-Jones, for example, was a very prominent preacher in this day, and he also stood for truth. But he came up within a denomination that he was already naturally a part of that was fairly sound, and he was able to do that patient work of reform within it. Whereas Pink, he didn't belong to any denomination from the start, and so here he is just bouncing from one place to another. The Baptist Union would not have him because he was a Calvinist. The Brethren churches would not have him either for the same reason. He ministered amongst the Brethren churches for a time. The strict and particular Baptist churches would not have him, for he opposed their hyper-Calvinism. He grew very much more unpopular, I think, when he began to oppose dispensationalism, which was spreading like wildfire at that time. One thing you need to know when you're reading A.W. Pink, if you ever decide to read all of his works, is that you do need to recognize that there is a progression in them. Early on in his ministry, when he wrote, he was promoting dispensationalism. He grew up under dispensational leaders, and he did listen to these men who were mentors to him. But later in his life, he began to consider dispensationalism more closely, and he began to wholeheartedly oppose it. Now, if dispensationalism is the popular thing, and you're one of the only voices out there saying this is rotten to the core, obviously it's going to affect your readership, and your opportunities for taking a call in a particular church are going to be greatly minimized, and so on and so forth. So you see how he was in some ways a product of his time. His temperament might have had something to do with his isolation, but also just the culture around him probably had something to do with it as well. To oppose dispensationalism, it does seem that something of their low view of the church did stick with him to the end, though. If Pink did write something on the church, a doctrine of the church, I probably wouldn't recommend it. Something just seemed to be slightly amiss, you know. He did promote church attendance and involvement in church in his writings, but I wonder if he wasn't a little bit too harsh in his critique of the church, too idealistic, as if we have to find a perfect and pure church to join ourselves to. That's not always possible. It's never possible to find a perfect and pure church, and sometimes it's not even possible to find a really healthy church. But should we withdraw from the church altogether? That is what Pink and his wife did, and I don't think we should follow them in this regard. Okay? Gives you a sense of the man, doesn't it? I think his writings are excellent, especially those written in his later years. And we are going to consider his book, The Attributes of God. I wanted to really quickly just go over the table of contents with you to give you an idea of where we are going. When we talk about the attributes of God, what are we talking about? Anyone want to give a shot at that question? Yes, Tim.
I guess you would call it divine perfections, characteristics, properties, qualities.
Okay, yeah, we're talking about, yeah, his qualities. I'm glad that you used the word divine perfections, Tim. I actually had a note here to highlight that, and you brought it up. It's important to understand that when we talk about God's attributes, his characteristics, we're talking about things that are perfections in him. So we might talk about one another and the attributes or characteristics that we have, and we might say that so-and-so is a really kind-hearted person. You know, it's a quality that they possess. Are we saying that they are perfectly kind-hearted always? No. So-and-so is very loving. Are they perfectly loving? No. And so on and so forth. We say that so-and-so is very godly or holy. Are they perfectly godly or holy? No, we are not saying that. But when we turn our attention to God and we begin to consider his attributes, we are really talking about things that are in him perfect. God is love, perfectly so, right? God is holy, perfectly so, so on and so forth. So the title is The Attributes of God, but you'll see that Pink in his writings does kind of alternate between the use of the term attributes and perfections as he writes. Let me read through the table of contents quickly, and then we'll just conclude, leave time for question and answer a little bit, see if I can do any good there. But there are 24 chapters. We're going to cover them in 20 weeks. The solitariness of God, he is utterly unique. He is not like us. The decrees of God, he is a God who decrees things. The knowledge of God, the foreknowledge of God, the supremacy of God, the sovereignty of God, the immutability, God does not change, the immutability of God, the holiness of God, the power of God, the faithfulness of God, the goodness of God, the patience of God, the grace of God, the mercy of God, the loving kindness of God, the love of God. Strangely, this actually, I think, is a doctrine that's very much misunderstood in our day, having to do with the love of God. It'll be an interesting chapter, I think. The wrath of God, the contemplation of God, the bounties of God, the gifts of God, the guidance of God, the blessings of God, the cursings of God, the gospel of the grace of God is chapter 24. I think we're in for a treat. Pink could have chose to organize his book differently to treat different subjects and leave others out, but here is how he chose to organize his book. I don't know that we'll agree with it on every single point. I'm not quite sure. We'll see. But I'll teach you what Pink has said, and maybe we'll offer some critique from time to time. Do you guys have any questions? 9:36. We have 10 minutes. Yes.
I'm missing a bunch of chapters.
Seven chapters.
Are you serious?
Yeah. There's only 17
chapters. That's funny. That's not funny. All right, I'm going to redo the schedule. That's the only thing to be done. Yeah.
On the attributes of God, you mentioned there, you can get it online, PDF.
Yeah.
They differ. But if you want the complete attributes of God, I can even give it to you to put it online. It's the, I gave you the book.
Gleanings
of the
Godhead. Oh, of the Godhead. Okay.
And it has all the attributes that original plus other.
Okay. Well, forgive me, church. That's embarrassing. I called up Solid Ground Christian Books, my friend Mike Gadosh over there. I said, would you send me 20 or whatever copies of The Attributes of God? And that's what he sent me. So I guess it's not just that this one is orange and that one is tan. That's a bit condensed. The only thing to do, since you guys have this particular version, is I'll go back on the website here and alter the schedule to fit the book that you have. There might be another approach to take, I don't know, which is to provide the other chapters to you via in PDF form. I'll think about that a little bit, okay, if we want to make it through the whole 24 chapters. So, or you can all get this book. I don't know. I don't know if I want to make you guys. I will not make you buy this book. So forgive me for that. That's embarrassing. Any other questions?
Good to know you're not perfect,
Joe. Oh, yeah. You just figured that out, huh, Dana, right now. Cool. I think he overworked. There was something about his temperament that wasn't too healthy. It manifests itself in his reclusiveness and his inability to relate super well with others, lack of pastoral patience, you know. But I think, yes, there was a time in his life where he just flat out pushed himself way too hard. And I think he matured from that experience of having just a legitimate nervous breakdown and having to be nursed back to health.
Couldn't it also be, though, that he was just discouraged because he wasn't getting the results that probably be expected? And you see that in other church characters, too. Like, I think it was William Carey who wasn't getting all kinds of results that he expected when he went on missionary tours. And then John Gill was also criticized because he said, spent so much time in his study. But the results of that are that he's reached a lot more people than he would have through his personal experience.
Sure. Yes, I know that is also the case. In fact, his wife Vera would testify to that, that he was most discouraged by just the low condition of the church. It would really get him down. And this biography on A.W. Pink is really outstanding. See, Pink not only wrote lots of books, that magazine, Studies in the Scriptures, but he wrote so many letters, personal correspondence. And it's actually in those private letters that have been preserved that we gain an insight into A.W. Pink as a person. Very rarely does he bring personal issues out at all in his preaching or in his writing or in his publications. You get little glimpses here and there. But it's in his personal correspondence that you begin to see what made the man tick. And without a doubt, one of the things that contributed to his period of despair was just disappointment concerning the church and the low state of the church in his day. So, but the Lord did sustain him and end up using him mightily. Okay. Anything else? Next week I'll come with an outline and we'll begin to go through the attributes of God and I'll figure out this issue here and let you guys know. I'm sorry. Man, figured it was the same book. Okay. Let's close with a word of prayer and then we'll transition to our time of worship. Our Father in heaven, we thank you for this book that we have before us that will aid us in understanding more of who you are, God. And we thank you for A.W. Pink, for his life. Lord, he, like the rest of us, was certainly imperfect and flawed. Lord, but you did use him, you preserved him, Father, and we give you thanks for that. We pray, Lord, that you would be with us as we progress through this study, that we would take the truths that are learned here and that we would apply them to our lives. Lord, may we be overwhelmed with you to see you as you are in all of your glory and splendor and all of your perfections. Lord, I pray that the end result is that we would trust in you more deeply. It's in the name of Christ we pray. Amen.